their education, and their career path after law school to explore the idea that there is no one way to be a lawyer. For other episodes of the Q Law Podcast, visit soundcloud.com/queens-law or your favorite podcast provider. In this week's episode, Afshin chats with Justice Donald McLeod, Law 95, who is also an adjunct professor at Queen's Law, where he teaches both trial advocacy and critical race theory. As a law student, Justice McLeod was class VP and Queen's Chapter President of the Black Law Students Association of Canada. After being called to the bar in 1998, Justice Donald McLeod began practicing criminal law. A few years later, he founded the McLeod Group, focusing on criminal law trials and appeals, as well as administrative law. And in 2013, McLeod was appointed to the Ontario Court of Justice. We hope you enjoy this episode.
So today is a really, really, really special episode that I've been looking forward to all semester and last year when we first conceived what we would be doing for season two. So we've got with us Justice Donald McLeod. And if any of you have had the pleasure of taking trial advocacy, it is just the best ride I've had. One of my favorite rides in all of law school. So I'm so excited. Thank you so much, Justice M, for coming today.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure. I loved you in the class. I remember some of the things that you did in it. And this is a great initiative. So I'm ready to get it on with you.
All right. So we've got some really exciting topics that we're talking about today. And let's just go right into it. So one of the things that I loved about being in your class is that it was our first connecting point. And this was that you and I have like a similar upbringing. But before we even get into that, I'm going to tease the audience. We have some upbringing. We're going to talk about some cool topics. We're going to talk about code switching. We're going to talk about, oh, you're not even ready for this. But before we even get into all that, I want to ask, what's a day in your life like? So usually we shoot this on Tuesdays and we ask what was Monday like, but just to like give a little bit more flavor of a full day, let's talk about what Friday was like for you. So that's today's Monday, so 3 days ago on Friday. If you could walk us through morning until you signed off.
All right, so Fridays are interesting days for me. I'm usually delivering a judgment on that day. I usually put judgments over to Fridays. I would have gotten up fairly early and went to work out, so fairly early meaning at 5 o'clock. Got back home. I would have, and in fact, on Friday, had this very interesting conversation with my son, who's in his third year at U of T. And so we were talking about that and laughing. Actually, the conversation was around who's the GOAT. And so I had MJ, and he was like, "Dad, I think it's LeBron." I'm saying, "Son, I think it's MJ." He's like, "No, Dad, I think it's LeBron." So we had that conversation for a good 20 minutes or so while we were having breakfast. And then I usually get into the office anywhere from 8:30 to 9 o'clock. When I get in there, I was actually prepping for this particular judicial pretrial that I had. But I also had a speaking engagement on Friday. So since it was the beginning of Black History Month, I had to speak at a high school. And so I spoke there for, you know, a couple of hundred kids. Then came back to the office. After I came back to the office, I then delivered one of two judgments that were on that day. Heard the remainder of a trial that I was in a continuation for. Finished its continuation. Actually went to a meeting. Yes, yeah, so those are my days. I went to a meeting after. After the meeting was done, I went home. I am the one that usually cooks at my house, surprisingly enough. Yes.
Oh, so, oh. What you know about that
work-life
balance?
Oh, that's right. So I got in and I got it done in the house. We had dinner and then we just chilled out for the rest of the evening. But that was the day. That was, sometimes it's almost like I had 2 days in one day. That was actually just one full day.
Yeah, I was kind of losing track of whether or not I'm like, wait, so.
And then the last thing I had to do that I'm thinking about it is that after we had dinner and then we chatted, then I was actually preparing because I had to give a speech the following day.
Okay.
And then the following day was myself, Justice Tulloch, and a judge from the Supreme Court of Canada. We all were judging the moot.
Oh.
The Julius Isaacs moot.
Oh, that's that's so cool. Yeah, that did happen.
So I was preparing that at the end of the night.
Oh, that is... Whoa. Okay, that's so right. Just out of curiosity, what time did you wake up and what time did you go to sleep?
So woke up at 5.
Oh.
And then went to bed at around 12.
Okay, so yes. For all our listeners, that is 5 a.m. and then 12 a.m.
Yeah.
This is the life of a justice.
Yeah. But it's good life all the same.
That is wild. Okay, also, I feel like our viewers need to know, for this episode, you know, we are always talking in, like, the mainstream language, what have you, but we are going to be talking in a little bit of slang. So if you're not familiar with what we're saying, I'm just going to translate where I can. So goat, as Justice mentioned, G-O-A-T, greatest of all time. So all y'all who are listening, mm-hmm. just letting you know. Because sometimes, you don't know, people don't know, but we want this to be accessible to people.
That's right.
Which is, like, pretty sick. And I think it was your class where I did the phenomenon of, like, really opening up and talking in what is actually my more authentic way of speaking.
Yes.
And which is, like, using a lot of slang and things like that. So why don't we go into that? So let's talk about who was Justice M before Justice M, before law school even.
Right.
Like, what was life like? Tell us a little bit about your upbringing. And we're going to get into your career, because y'all, you guys are about to listen to the biggest flex of all time. Oh my goodness. So, but before all that, before law school, let's just talk about what life was like.
So I was, come to Canada. I was actually born in England, by way of the West Indies. Then I lived at Regent Park, so Belshaw Place, that was my spot. Moved from there, then moved to Scarborough, to another spot of Toronto community housing called Gilder. So I lived in maybe subsidized housing for years, 26 years or somewhere thereabouts. But, you know, growing up, I was your typical kid. I liked, as I told my class last year, I liked girls and basketball. That's what I did. I was good at both, and that was the way that I sort of ruled the world. You know, I grew up just like any inner city kid. I just lived that life. And, you know, for me, growing up was a fantastic opportunity to be able to, like, see my neighborhood, see the people that I grew up with, hang out. I wasn't really a great high school student, so as I said, those two subjects were the ones that sort of ruled the day for me. But I think for the most part, you know, look, it's that was my flex. Those were my ends.
Yeah.
My ends were Scarborough. That's what I knew. That's what I knew all about. I didn't really vary out of Scarborough much until I got into university. But for the most part, that's where my creative came from. That's where my understanding came from. That's where my common sense was born.
Mm-hmm.
And so even when you were in my class, and as you said, there were some things that we did that were a little different.
Yeah.
That all comes from the upbringing that I have, right? Mm-hmm. From the questions mm-hmm. that I ask, to the way that I ask them, to the way that I dress, to the way that I, you know, hang out. All of those things would have been as a result of where I grew up and how I grew up.
Mm. And I think there's something to be said about the intentionality. I think when you don't grow up within, like, dominant Canadian mainstream culture, or the cultures that a lot of the lawyers who are in the legal field grew up within, and if you're outside of those conditions, we have to be so intentional about the choices we make.
Yes.
And I think that extra thinking is something that needs to be appreciated.
Yes.
So I'm actually also, for those who are listening, honestly, I never in my lifetime thought that I would have someone teaching me in law school who also grew up in TCHC, subsidized housing. Because, y'all, you do not understand. There is a big difference between people who grew up in TCHC and people who didn't who come to law school.
Yes.
Could you share a little bit about that and your time at Queen's Law? Because I'm just curious to see what has changed since your time, my time. Like, how has the infrastructure changed? What still needs to change? Things like that. Like, you know, just some real talks.
Well, you know, look, when I came here, this was a... Look, I grew up in a neighborhood that was predominantly black.
Mm-hmm.
So 99.9% of the people that lived at Gilder, that went to the high school that I went to, the grade school that I went to, were black.
Mm.
Then I went to Mac, which was an eye-opener. And then I came to Queens, which was a very different experience. I think that there was a spattering of black law students that were here. It wasn't as racialized as it is now.
Yes.
And I think the, you know, there was an intention to that. I mean, you know, Flanagan, who was actually taught me property when I was here, had a meeting with me, you know, 9 years ago to see whether or not I would teach here or be willing to teach here. And so that was an interesting change, just having racialized professors that were here. But for me, I think what was different now, like I see the culture now, there is a... Mine was the beginning or the embracing of culture, of race. The Black Law Students Association had just started maybe 2 years before I got here. We started seeing black students here. And I didn't feel as comfortable with the campus at large because it was just so different. To tell you, when I got here, I remember the people that lived upstairs, they went to Havergal and they went to UCC. And I was up there talking to them, and at one point I said to them, what are you guys talking about? I'd never heard of these schools before. I was 21 years old, and I'd never heard of the school Havergal, and I'd never heard of UCC. I'd never heard of any of these private schools. I didn't know anything about them. And so as people were talking, assuming that I would have known them, I didn't. And so... this school was a culture shock for me in more ways than one. But that being said, did I like the law school? I did. I absolutely loved it. I loved this as a university town. I got to know very good friends who are still friends of mine now, from all different races and backgrounds. And so there was a learning that I got here, a learning and an understanding that I sort of became able to appreciate as a result. And so I wouldn't actually change it. I wouldn't want to go anywhere else. I'm glad I came to Queens.
Oh, that's so wholesome. Yeah, I actually want to revisit this idea of culture shock because I think I had mentioned to you that I've been at Queens forever. And so this is now my ninth year at Queens. This will be my ninth year finishing. And I thought, okay, I saw it all. You know, I did my undergrad here, then I did my Bachelor of Education here, then I did my master's here. And I'm like, no, I've seen it all. Then I came to law school and I faced a culture shock. Right when I came to law school, because it was, like you were saying, there's a much more dense population, I think, of people who, and again, this isn't a positive or negative statement. It's a neutral statement. It's an observation. There's a dense population of people who are from a higher socioeconomic background, those who have come from private school education, and there's a very stark difference between these upbringings. And so I remember telling you that I grew up on the Esplanade, which is the hood that's adjacent to Regent Park. So we're neighboring
hoods.
Right. Oh my goodness. So it was like, I still remember the first day when I came to Queens University in general. So this is my undergrad 9 years ago. I'm really aging myself, but you know what? It's okay. Because age is just a number. So I came and I remember one of the first things we were just talking about, oh, what are the things that happened to you this week? And I had casually just mentioned, oh yeah, you know, my neighbor was shot last week. And people were just, I just killed the conversation. I killed the dinner. The mood was dead for the rest of the day.
Right,
and I thought,
right.
I didn't mean to do that. And then I realized, oh, Afshin, listen, like you've lived a life that's very different where this is not the everyday. And it's also the same thing in terms of growing up where I was, my sister and I were the only brown kids at our school. And then there was maybe a handful of East Asian people. And like in terms of racial diversity, it was a predominantly black neighborhood. So many of my classmates in the culture I grew up with also contributed to this idea of growing up in an inner city where there's a lot of cultures feeding into the way we speak. So it wasn't just that we were picking up on a certain culture's language, but there was just an amalgamation of so many different cultures. It's the reason why if you go to Toronto, you'll have non-Muslims saying things like, yo, wallah, and things like that. So it's just like, you know, it's just because of the way we talk. And it's like, you know, it's not a religious thing. It's like, this is just the slang. This is just who we are.
That's right, that's right.
So I wanted to, like, bring this in and thinking about, okay, so here we are, like, growing up in TCHC and growing up in the hood and having these kinds of, just like these like tools and the way that we've seen the world. And also now we're getting into the topic of code switch. So just for those of you who've never heard code switch before, we could give you a little, rundown over here. So we got to credit a lot of the black academics and scholars who've really done a lot of heavy lifting in helping us understand the sociological phenomenon of code switching, especially black women scholars. And so the way that we understand this phenomenon, this code switching idea, it's like this sociological adaption, where you're talking and speaking and appearing and behaving in one way in a certain setting, but then you change it, and usually you change it to appease to the dominant culture. And the dominant culture might be so that you can get fair treatment or better quality service or even employment opportunities. And this really links to us at Queen's
yes,
Law.
That's right.
As people who want to go into law, and we go through things like the OCI, which is on-campus interviews for those of you who are outside of the legal field or new to the legal field. We have this formalized interview process, and we have a lot of different stages of interviews. So just kind of thinking of, okay, code switch. It's this phenomenon where we switch up. So, for example, growing up in the hood for me meant that there's a way that I talked and a way that I spoke that I completely changed in order to be seen as an intellect
yeah.
and someone who is a human being who's of the same caliber or should be given the same kind of treatment. And I intentionally, if anyone's taking my class right now in 3L, the way I do not code switch, I just talk now in my authentic self. Honestly, a lot of it is also credited to like taking a class with someone like you, where I felt comfortable to kind of ease into it, and now I'm full on talking in slang. Like,
yes.
I'm out here in admin law, dropping whatever I can. Like, today I was like, yo, Professor Reinhardt, hold the phone. I went into my little legal analysis, but it's because I think it's so important for us to see, like, an intellect can sound different. There are different ways. There's not one way to be a lawyer.
Yes.
And that's the thesis of our show. And there's not one way to be an intellect. And I think it's really important to do. So, like, just in terms of, I've given you a law right now. I've given
yeah.
you a law. But I'm just kind of wondering, did you code switch to get to where you are today as Justice McLeod?
So I think, you know, I can sum it up in some ways.
Okay.
So when, this is a very interesting example. When I go back and play ball in my old neighborhood, or, you know, because I still can hoop, I can still get up in there and do what needs to be done to get it done.
Like, you
so,
need to understand, this is like, you're like
so,
top 10 coolest people I've ever met.
So my friends who know me, when I play ball, I'm usually very more reserved. It's hard to get me out of my comfort zone. I know, you know, what's going on. So my friends who know that I'm a judge, they call me Just Ice.
No way.
Yes. But when I'm now at, you know, in other circles, they call me Justice.
Okay.
So you can see that there is the idea that there is still a respect that comes with the post or with the job. But there's also an understanding that they've now put it on my personality. So
mm-hmm.
they're like Just Ice. Like, you know, it's
yeah.
just now I would never have seen the word broken down like that. Unless
yeah.
it was from my old neighborhood, right?
Yeah.
I've never heard anyone call anyone else Just Dice. Like,
yeah.
it's just from my neighborhood, right?
Yeah.
And so when we're talking about the idea of code switching, and I think now I'm seeing it in, you know, having persons like you in my class, I think the idea of allowing us, what law school did was it intellectualized our common sense.
Mm.
And so it didn't teach us necessarily new things or a different way of thinking, but what it did was it gave us some words that we didn't have before, and then it allowed us to be able to integrate those words into our general lexicon.
Mm.
But it didn't take away from the fact that when we go back home, we still speak a certain way.
Yes.
And it's not, we're not speaking less, and we're not speaking down, we're not speaking, you know, unintelligibly, but what we're doing is we're allowing ourselves to let our hair down. There's some places where you wear a bow tie, and there's some places where you wear a tie. There's some places where you have coffee, and there's some places where you have tea. And I think the integration of equity into the marketplace that they call Queen's Law is really the integration of changing the allowing us to feel comfortable with being who we are, and then allowing you to understand that we are this way because this is how we choose to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so really, there's some places that you may speak French, and there's some places where you speak English, and there's some places where you'll speak, you know, but that's the whole idea behind code switching. And I think I think some people have misaligned it to say that it's more about intellectual prowess. It's not. It's simply just about being comfortable. It's,
mm-hmm.
you know, look, there's sometimes you can go down and deal with a mandem. like, you know, and that's from my neighborhood, right?
Yeah.
But I'm not going to say, I'm going to come down there and talk to all of you gentlemen. No, I'm going to, the mandem. Like, that's how we deal with things. And I think what we have learned and what we should be learning as persons who are racialized, persons who have come from different economic communities, is that our way is not any better or any worse. It's just our way. Mm-hmm. And we have forgotten, or sometimes the dominant class have made us believe that the way that we, even down to the way that we eat, the way that we enjoy food at a dinner table, like, you know, it's, you know, there are some places where you're not going to have roti with a knife and fork. You're not doing that. You're not having oxtail with a knife and fork. There's times when, you know, if I'm going over to someone's house, then I know we're going to eat a certain way. We're going to sit a certain way. And for many years, I think the dominant class, whether they intentionally tried to do it or not, made that feel inferior. And I think what we then learned as we became sort of individuals more aware of our surroundings was that, you know, it's okay to be me. And so when you say to me that, you know, in your class you felt that you can now speak the way that you want, I think that what it does is it warms my heart.
Oh.
Yeah, it does, because it makes me feel like, you know what, we're getting there. And people are now understanding that, you know, look, there's some places I'm in, and someone will say, look, are you telling the truth? And they're like, wallahi. I'm like, I got you there. If he says wallahi, it's the truth.
Yeah, listen, for all you Muslims and non-Muslims, you say wallah, you say wallahi, we believe you.
Yeah, that's right. It's
just an honor code.
That's right. And so those are the things that we understand. And I think there is a level of education that we received simply from growing up where we grew up. And I think I don't take away from it. I don't add to it. I don't denigrate it. I actually think that that's the school that I went to first. And that allowed me to be able to be the judge that I am, the father that I am, the husband that I am, the friend that I am, the brother that I am. I think all of those things, if I didn't have that upbringing, I would not be the person that I am.
You're just making me feel so pleased right now. This is so sweet. I actually wanted to go back to something that you were saying. So when I stepped into your class, it just completely blew my mind, because you're out here dropping slang left, right, and center. Just be out here saying all these things, and I'm like, oh my goodness. I would never thought, I conceived that this would happen in class. I just wonder, and this is, you know, a little PSA to all those who do hiring, representation matters so much, because it's like seeing this as a possibility model is what brings comfort into us as students to then take those courageous steps and be more authentic, to see authentic role models. And just a little plug, we got John McIntyre talking about authenticity in a few weeks, so stay tuned for that episode. But just in general, like, just being authentic, like, you were like such a possibility model for that, and I'm so thankful. I'm also just wondering, though, was there ever a point where you kind of played the game? Like, I call it the respectability politics game, you know. This is another academic term, but it's kind of like you play the game of representing yourself and what is, like, the dominant, the norm, which is talking in a certain way, which is, like, hoity-toity. So if anyone's wondering, like, what I'm trying to say, it's, like, if you go to a job interview for a law firm, talking like that. You know what I'm trying to say? So it's like that. You put that on. Was there a point where you changed that up and where you switched it up so that you were talking in slang while you were also delivering lectures? Was it, like, always consistent? At what point did you feel comfortable enough to then be more in tune with that authentic self, and also, like, to mesh the worlds? Because, like, you're doing a little bit of, like, remix right here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the privilege of being a judge allows you to do things that maybe someone else wouldn't have been able to do right away. When you walk through the door, there's already a credibility that's entrenched in the person that you are the moment that someone is saying justice. Then there's an understanding that you know the law, that you work by the law, that you understand precedent, that you understand natural justice and the consequences of the law and where it actually leads one. So then it allowed me to be able to be even more myself, to realize that, you know what, I'm not talking about other people. I'm actually here. Like, I know what happens behind closed doors. I know what happens with my colleagues. I've seen them. I know how they organize themselves. And And then you realize that, you know what, I deserve to be here.
Yeah.
And so I think when you deserve to be somewhere, it gives you the liberty to be free and apply what it is that you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so before, when you were on the outside looking in, you couldn't help but wonder, do they actually do that when they're there?
Mm.
But then now that I'm there, I realize I'm the one that you're talking about. And so yeah. I think it gives us a... It gives us a comfortability. And so even when I was in law school, I still spoke the same way. I mean, obviously, if you're having an interview, you're going to speak a certain way. It's the same way that if you're going to church, you're going to wear a suit as opposed to jeans, right? It wasn't something that I was proud of who I was.
Yeah.
And then I was proud of where I was from. And then, you know, like, as someone would say, like, I rep Scarborough hard. Like, that's that's like my spot. Like, I'm not making it up. I'm not doing this for somebody. I literally am just this.
Mm-hmm.
And so when if I speak patois, it's because I can.
Yes, yes.
Right?
Yes.
If I speak a certain vernacular, it's because that's what I'm used to.
Yes.
But in the same vein, I'm saying to those persons that are in the class, like, don't sleep on the idea that there is veracity in what I'm saying.
Mm.
The way that I wish to convey my thoughts may be at times, you know, one way or the other. It doesn't take away from its intensity.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, what it may do is it may make it more intense if I say it this way as opposed to the other way.
Mm.
And so when I decide, and I don't even think it was intentional, I just really said, this is how I am.
Yeah.
And I think that I felt strong enough in my person that you could take me or not.
Mm.
But I think, you know, and I think as racialized individuals, as all of us are in this room, I think one of the things that we are learning and continue to learn is that, you know, we don't have to believe what people said before. Now, I am a representation of who I am, of the community that I represent. You can take that or not, but I was wise enough and strong enough and bright enough to be here, just like you.
Mm.
And so I may not speak Estonian, I may not be able to speak Quebecois, but I speak this.
Mm.
And mm-hmm. and it is just as... it should be just as paramount, just as present, just as strong, just as determined, just as resolveful as anything else that you would say.
Okay. So. I'm just like listening. I'm like, this is just so beautiful. I can't, I'm just like getting into the words. I wanted to actually talk about this then. So I kind of want to go back to law school, and I'm wondering if the way that we're raised, I feel like I already have my own prediction, but I wonder if the way that we're raised and brought up and the way we speak and the communities that we interact with also informs the kind of law that we gravitate towards.
Yes.
So I want to kind of go back to your time at Queen's Law, because we got another criminal law baddie in the room. Everyone who listens to the show is going to be like, yo, this girl is obsessed with criminal law. But it's I actually mentioned you the last episode that we did with Colonel Kerr.
Okay,
and I was
yes.
like, yo, so Justice McLeod said that the sexiest law is
That's
criminal
right.
law. Yeah,
sexiest
I quoted
law.
You. Yeah, yeah. And so I'm kind of wondering if you felt like there was a connection, because I know that your heart was with criminal law, and after leaving law school, you did practice it for a bit.
Yeah.
So was this something that clicked for you during law school when you were here?
So it did. Of course, you know, many of my colleagues were not interested in criminal law. It was not what was going to pay the bills for mm-hmm. them. It was not something that they felt was economically viable. But I actually felt differently. Mm-hmm. I felt that, you know what, if you're good at this, you'll be surprised just how well and how far it will take you. And so I did. And also, I came from a community that didn't have a voice.
Yeah.
And so that actually spurred me in that direction as well, in that any kind of law that I was going to do or wanted to do, I wanted to make sure that that was the type of law that would benefit not just myself, but my community. And so the other thing that I married it with it was the things that I was interested in. So, of course, mm-hmm. I did criminal, sports, entertainment, and admin law. That was what my firm did.
Okay.
But for me, criminal law, advocacy, standing there, pronouncing the things on your soapbox, which is now the courtroom, and able to tell a judge, you know what, this is why this is right. This is why this should be followed, I think had a lot to do with how I grew up. And so I didn't really listen to the people that were around me. I mean, for those who are from Kingston, yes, when the law firms came out, I would have my share of dinners at what they call Shea Piggy, which I understand is still here.
But
I went with my heart. And I will say this to others in this profession, other students, that, you know, go with your heart first instead of with the pocketbook. You'd be surprised. Your pocketbook will catch up. It may even pass and surpass those that are around you because you had such a love for it. But I was determined to be a criminal lawyer. And everything that I did pointed me in that direction.
Right. And, okay, I have a follow-up question. So
yes.
This is the thing. It's our life experiences bring us so much closer to what we want to do and where we want to be.
Yes.
And then something that I think students also grapple with is it too close to home? So, for example, when I was studying for my first 1L midterm, and this is for December in 2021, and I'm studying for criminal law midterm and Professor Lisa Kelly's class, shout out to the Queen, and it was absolutely wild, because here I was learning about bail and bail conditions and just like the onus and the crown and this and that, and I'm reading these cases, and then that is when I also learned that one of my friends was in jail and needed bail. It rhymes anyway. And then I thought, okay, like it was just kind of a surreal moment where I'm like, this is not just what I'm studying, but this is real life.
That's
and
right.
This is like a kind of a common occurrence. It's something that I studied all throughout my life. So even my master's, I study a lot of criminal justice and prison justice and abolition, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's just stuff that clicked with me, because I have classmates who've gone to jail and prison, and people close to me who've been interacting with the criminal justice system. And so I just have this, an epistemic advantage.
Yes.
In terms of just knowing what it's like from a very different vantage point. But at what point, how do you reconcile the closeness of the content with practicing what you want to do without it being too close to home, where it kind of gets in the way of like your well-being?
So I think, you know, for me, obviously we realize that when we grow up where we grow up, that there is a spattering of interests. You've got people that starting their own businesses. You have persons who just want to be able to, you know, interact with the community in a particular way. And then you've got individuals as well that have been in trouble. And so what happens for those of us that are from these communities is that we end up almost being a jack of all trades. Mm-hmm. The expectation is that we'll be able to help and not hinder, that we'll be able to give information to those persons that require it. Is it close to home? Well, everything's close to home. I mean, whether they be someone that's in trouble or someone that wants to start a business or someone that's, you know, interested in law in and of themselves or wants to be a teacher. I think the melting pot, so to speak, of community housing means that we may be so many different things at so many different times. Mm-hmm. You know, many of us grew up without our fathers, so then we find that there's a lot of counseling that needs to be done, or there are conversations that we're all having together, or they may call you in now and say, hey, look, you know, can you help us out with this or help us out with that? The other thing is that we actually, as a result of this profession, become almost like the county lawyer. Everybody, and all of a sudden at a dinner table, is like, you know, what do you, Afshin, can you help us with this? We don't know what's going on here. You have to know a bit about family, about immigration, about criminal, about
it's
business.
True, it's true.
And so, you know, we recognize the sacrifice of those that came the generation before us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we recognize that there's an expectation that's placed on us that we have to give back what we've learned into a community who didn't have it before. And to think that, you know, many times we're the first in that community to become lawyers, the first to graduate from university, the first to be in technology or in, you know, in the professions that we're in. And so then your phone will ring and your mom will say, this is Auntie so-and-so, and she used to change your diaper when you were this age, and, you know, and her internet's down. Can you fix it for me? And you're like, look, I told you that I went to school for this, but I don't know how that works. Well, you have to tell her, walk her through it.
Yeah.
And so we can be anything from going to your house to make sure your cable works to, you know, going and making sure that we can help you with a living will to anything. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, we will take pride in being able to do that. And the other thing that I will say is that going into the law, in the areas of law that I did, made me realize that there was a utility in my community. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, I didn't have to worry about money because I recognized that my community had its own wealth. Mm-hmm. And just needed to know where to put that. Mm-hmm. And so before, when we were looking for other lawyers to do different things, now I was here.
Okay.
And so it allowed me to start a firm. It allowed me to have different associates and paralegals and law clerks and the like that were all in the same, they were all in that office with me. And wouldn't have been able to do that if we didn't have a community that had resources.
Yeah, it's a very creative economy.
Yes, that's right. It is.
Yeah, I was talking about this because I'm like, we could be, human beings are more, we have the capacity to be more creative with our economy. And this is like one of those like beautiful ways that can happen.
Yes.
I also really like this idea of that. I think sometimes I see in social justice advocacy spheres that sometimes we treat struggle as virtue, as if it's something that makes, I don't know, a part of our identity and something to somehow, like, there's like an oppression Olympics sometimes that takes place.
Yeah, like we're martyrs.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, oh my God, look at me. I'm so intersectional. Yeah.
But I'm saying this as I know that I'm sure you're going to go to another topic, but you know, even sitting here and doing this, you know, I'm proud of you. I think, you know, because it's a talent that you have. Look, I've been interviewed hundreds of times. I've been on Fox. I've been on CNN. I've been on CBC. I have done this, that, and the other. I've been in documentaries, you name it. And I'm sitting here and I'm saying, Afshin is, she's not letting the gaps go. She understands when to let someone talk, when to come in. So I say that because, you know, in some respects, we're unilingual. Mm. We are trilingual, whatever the word is. We have so many talents at our disposal that we don't recognize that law can't hold us. Mm. And so, you know, when I'm sitting here, I'm saying to myself, you know, looking at you as a student and someone who's got a breadth of information and understanding that you can code switch when you need to. You can let us know just how intelligent you are when it presents itself and is necessary in an interview. You can be so many different things, yet at the same time still be you.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, one of the things that equity brought is not just equality, but understanding that there's an equity in us, that we come here resourceful, that the school, with the mere fact that Afshin is here, is why this podcast can still function in the way that it does. If you were not here, then we would not be able to do this. And I think what happens is the environment, there's this idea of convergence in critical race theory, mm-hmm. when it's almost like this understanding that as there is a utility that is seen in something, it now shifts or changes the equity or the balance of power, mm-hmm. which is what we're seeing here, right? Mm-hmm. There's a reason why this podcast is still running. It's a reason why it's still being heard and listened to. And I think it's a testament not just to you, but also to the school environment, to understand that we can't just do things the way that we used to. And so when you're talking about taking advantage of the things that we have, I think the advantage that you have here is that you're able to do this innately. You're able to do this because it's a gifting that you've been able to inherit, that you can have conversations with different people, which in and of itself is code switching, right? You can have this conversation with me as a judge and have another one with a professor and then have another one with someone who's worked in different spheres. And so, you know, you would have cultivated that right from where you grew up.
Yeah, yeah, I like what you're saying about that. So a lot of people do this code switching on an everyday basis, but before, sorry. Also, thank you.
No.
Yeah, it's my heart right now.
You got an interview to do, so you better get to the next question.
You're making me feel all kinds of ways right now. But I also love that you brought this up because we all are code switching. And I think it's not that it's inherently a bad thing to code switch.
No, it's
just
not.
Becomes a problem when we're code switching because people look at us and have a certain expectation.
That's right.
And then that there are are negative connotations to a certain type of code that we need to switch out of just to legitimize ourselves.
That's
so
right.
That is the point where, like, it kind of turns into a problem. And even going back to this idea of, like, you know, the oppression Olympics and struggler's virtue and stuff, just walking down the hall at Queen's Law, we've got all the graduating class photos and all the people, and we get to see how Queens start to become more and more and more diverse.
Yes.
And it's like, the thing that we need to celebrate and have gratitude for is that we're not meant to struggle the same way that maybe you did when you came. Not, it's not a Queen's Law thing, it's just in the world.
That's right.
And
that's right.
The fact that people like you went through, and hopefully what we're going to do is that we want the future generations to have less of that struggle. So struggle,
yes,
shouldn't be virtue. It's just something that we're trying to hope to minimize for people.
That's right.
And that's,
yeah,
what we're trying to do with the code switch. So it's like, how can we go through this world and actually recognize that it's not, it's a tool, but it doesn't have to be something that's negative.
No.
And in fact, maybe we could use it as a tool to, like, succeed in this world. But
And I think that we will. And I think when we're looking at the multi-layers that come with being lawyers, with being racialized individuals, I think what the world is waking up to, when you look at, say, Pellier Rowland, and you're looking at the firms that say that you're going to, or that others are going to. I was talking to someone downstairs who's going to Stikeman's,
mm-hmm,
you know, again, a racialized woman. I think the environment is understanding that if we stay stagnant,
mm-hmm,
if we continue to perpetuate what we've been doing for such a long time,
mm-hmm,
we will actually lose our viability.
Yeah.
We will be of no use to anybody, and we would not have changed with the times.
Yeah, like, don't play the game so hard that you actually lose yourself.
Yeah.
And you're erased. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we are fighting to make sure that we continue to keep and maintain and get ground in,
mm-hmm,
this place that we call law.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can see it more with the bench changing, the complexion of the bench has changed. You know, yesterday or on Friday, as I was telling you, or Saturday when I was judging the moot, you know, the Chief Justice of the Court of Appeal is a black man.
Yeah.
And so there is myself and Justice Tulloch, and we're there in his chambers, and we're just laughing at the fact that, you know, look at this. You never saw this coming, you know?
That's awesome.
Yeah, so I think it's important for us to ensure that generations build on a generation before, right? And so we'd seen where we saw maybe one or two judges that were black. Now all of a sudden we're seeing, you know, 8 or 9 or 10.
Yeah.
And, you know, so for 10 years I was the only black judge in the Ontario Court of Justice, and now there's,
oh,
as in the past 6 months, there's been another,
wow,
that's now come on, who's also from Queens.
What? Say,
yeah,
word!
So Justice,
okay,
Cornelius. And
okay,
so,
okay.
I think, you know, when we start looking, I mean, as I say to people, that I'm the first black judge to graduate from Queens.
Yep.
And when I look at the wall, which I still have from my picture
up, I was just about to bring
up
the wall. So, y'all, if you go to Letterman Library and you walk up, there's a wall of judges. And for some reason, Justice M still got to take a picture.
I don't know why I just can't get a picture up there. It's my fault. I just haven't given it to them. It's not like a conspiracy or anything like that.
It's
just
I know. But you got, like, you dress fresh every day. You can take a picture right now, and it'll be great for the wall.
So I just got to put a robe on and take it. And that's it's been 10 years. Like, I've been a judge for 10 years.
Justice,
so there's a bunch of people up there wondering, where's McLeod?
Yeah, we got to get you up there. That's the goal of 2024.
Yes. I think you're right on that. I don't disagree.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's just incredible just to hear this, because it must have been lonely, those 10 years.
You know, lonely in a different way. I think, was it lonely?
Hmm.
You know, it's, you know, I'm thinking about that. I remember when I was, so my son went to a school called Crescent, and of course my son now goes to schools that I'd never heard of before. And I remember saying to my sister, in fact, that, you know, I wonder if it's okay for him to go there, because he's going to be a black kid surrounded by in a sea of white, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she would say to me, but he still comes home to a black house, right? He still comes home to a black family. His aunts and his uncles and his grandmothers, they're all still black. They're all racialized. And so as, but we also, as racialized individuals, are used to being in environments where we are the minority.
Yes.
So when we came to Queens as law students, there was very few of us.
Yeah.
So I don't think I felt lonely in that way. I think I felt important to say, you know, it may be good to be the first one, but you don't want to be the only one. So it meant then that, you know, when's the next one coming? What are we waiting for? What's the holdup? Why can't we get another black judge here? Is it that we don't have people applying? Like, what's the issue? And so then it's now that time to, as you're there, to be able to make sure that the door remains open.
Yeah.
And so it was more along the lines of not being lonely for where I was, but just being hungry for more.
Yes.
And so, you know, yes. and to make sure that we, you know, can, because we also change an environment once we're there.
Yes. Yes.
And so all of a sudden now we're there and things are being run a little differently, or the way that judgments are being spoken about are different, or in lunch, the conversation becomes a different conversation that may not have been there if we weren't there.
Yeah.
So I didn't feel as lonely, but I'm lonely is not what I felt, but I felt like I wanted somebody else too.
Yeah.
I wanted to share.
Yeah.
I wanted to make sure that we were able to share this with others.
Yeah, I think that's a really beautiful way to kind of shape that perspective. I'm also realizing that we've talked a lot about Justice Sem. We've talked a lot about law school Justice Sem.
Yes.
But we haven't really talked about, once you step foot outside of the law school, what was life like, and how did you go from law school to where you are today?
Oh,
this is where you get to flex on us.
I step out of law school. Many people didn't know that while I was in law school, I was a musician. So I was actually, yeah, this would be maybe a bit of an eye-opener for those that are listening here.
Yeah, but he's a man of many talents.
I was in a group that was signed to MCA Records. So I was actually, an artist. So, like, I was in tours, and I've been nominated for Junos. We did music videos when we left here. That was my world. So I'd done that all through law school, and that's why that creative part of me was still very active even leaving here. I then leave, and then I articled at a firm, it was actually at that time the largest criminal law firm in Canada. I was debating between going to civil or criminal, and I ended up going to criminal.
Mm-hmm.
Then left from there, went to a smaller law firm, and then eventually became a partner there, and then opened my own law firm in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd done a lot of cases by that point. So I'd done a fair amount of murder cases, admin cases. I'd now been to the Supreme Court of Canada. I'd been to the Court of Appeal. I had argued cases that now are in the books that we're reading here for criminal law. And then was able to make law, you know, on my own as interveners, and then I was also in charge of the legal department the legal committee for the African Canadian Legal Clinic at the time. Mm-hmm. So a decade worth of cases, from Williams to RDS to Golden to Hamilton and Mason, would have come through whilst I was there.
Yeah.
And so we saw the landscape of the law change.
Mm-hmm.
Like, where before it was just parks, then all of a sudden there's this chronology and lineage of cases that are coming through that we're a part of.
Yeah, and the court's just grappling with what is race,
exactly.
Then racialization, then
that's
race
right.
consciousness.
That's right.
Yeah, this is just notes from Justice Sem's critical race theory lecture. I'm just saying. Little plug over here. Justice Sem teaching critical race theory. Y'all gotta check it out.
so then leaving from there and doing that, and then eventually, you know, being appointed to the bench. It's been great. I've often told classes that I've never had a bad day in law ever.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I've never had a bad day in law. It wasn't hard for me. I didn't feel... But then also I realized that I had a natural inclination towards advocacy. And so it just seemed to work with my talents, my gifts. I could, you know, speak a certain way. I could articulate things a certain way, advocate, argue, stress. I could, you know, and so it was just natural for me to actually gravitate to this. So I was not, you know, I was not created, quote unquote, to be like a corporate lawyer. That was not going to work for me. If I wasn't in a room where I was going to advocate something, then I didn't want to be in that room.
Yeah. But it also sounds like right when you left law school, there's you could have gone into music full time, and that maybe you had two passions. One was advocacy, the other was music.
Yeah, that's right.
Did you have to make a choice between them, or?
So for the year after leaving law school and before Bar Ads finished, I did a lot of touring. So I actually toured more, and then so I was called to the bar after the tours were done, and and the music was not as strong as it was when I started. So we were that was my life. I used to leave law school on Fridays, and then I'd hop on a plane, go somewhere, study while I'm there, and then take the plane back, and then come to school on Monday. That was my life for 3 years, and so. I could have done both. I think I was glad that I did what I did in terms of music. Didn't have any regrets where that was concerned. And then also I made that part of my practice.
Yeah.
Because that's why I did sports and entertainment. So I'd represented a lot of people that I knew from entertainment. They'd come to me, and that's how my entertainment practice started.
Are you allowed to name drop anything?
but let's just say there are some names that are very, very popular even right now in music. And I would say that, they are, they don't go by their first names, but they go by their middle names.
All right. Yeah. I think y'all picking up what he's putting down, right?
So I think those were people that were coming out. And in fact, they would have been dealing with some of them just prior to actually getting appointed.
That is so cool.
Yeah. So that was,
that's so cool.
As they say, that was my flex.
Flex on, flex on all up. Yeah, that's what we're here for.
Yes.
Yeah, I feel like this whole interview ended up being like, I was like your hype man this whole time.
I don't know about that, but it was, I think when we're here talking, you do recognize just how it's nice to have similarities with people. It's nice to be able to be in this time in law where we could have a conversation like this.
Yeah.
About the subject matter like this.
Yeah.
When I was in law school, I don't think that we could have. We weren't quite there yet.
Right.
And I think maybe it was our own insecurities. We didn't have any black judges that we could have had come through and really just talk.
Right.
And then see that it was acceptable for them to do it, so then it became acceptable for me to do it.
Yeah.
I didn't see that. But as time went on, we got to see it more. That's why I think it's important to have alumni. That's why I think it's important to come back and teach here. I think it may make for a long day to get on a train. When I get up to get here, it's 4:45 in the morning, 4:30.
Yeah, I saw your email. Yeah. It's at 5:55 a.m. today.
which I was on the train now coming in, right?
Yeah.
But I think if we don't see like faces, if we don't have a chance to hear different experiences, then, for me, there was a woman that was here. Her name was Rosemary Ofe-Obawaji. Mm-hmm. And she was a black professor that came here. I think she was doing her PhD. Mm-hmm. And she ended up teaching law, gender and equality. Mm-hmm. But all of us as black students, we knew her. And we could go into her office and we could, sort of unpack the day. And she would understand it. And so that was an example that made me think, you know what? When the offer came, sure, I'll do it. Even if I'm coming from Toronto, so I use my holidays to come, and I think it's important. I think it's important that we're here and that we can have the meetings with our own, students that are here, racialized individuals that are here, and then make them feel comfortable in class.
Exactly.
So when I saw you talking about Biggie Smalls and child advocacy for an assignment that will remain nameless because we don't want to surprise the other ones before that are going to come in this year's class, when we saw different people talking about different things, you felt comfortable being able to say what you wanted to say.
Yeah, and the importance of, I love this idea of like building community. Yeah. Also, shout out to Balsa and the incredible work that student leaders are doing at Queen's Law, but obviously this month, just acknowledging how much student labor has gone in and how they've been also holding our institution accountable to be proactive in the coming years for Black History and Futures Month. So just a little shout out. The growth. Yeah.
And I think that growth has a lot to do with why critical race theory is being taught here.
Which is incredible because it went from this lecture that you taught where people can come in once a semester.
That's right.
Into a full-on course that is actually, from what I'm hearing, I'm so jealous that I'm not in it. I hear about these amazing conversations that are taking place. Yes. And it's just, I can't even imagine what that does for the legal field, that there are going to be people who are law students becoming lawyers who will have this information.
Yes, exactly.
Like, it
is good to see, and it's good to see the participation. And when you say the course is very multicultural, it is. You literally have a spattering of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the beauty of the course is that it doesn't allow, or it allows everybody to really be themselves. And so, as I would in child advocacy, you know, challenge and, you know, talk about and question and query. And it's very open. Like, I think it takes a while for people to be... to consider it a safe space.
Yeah, building that trust.
Yeah, and yet I found that with them, they are. They're getting there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and now willing and prepared to speak their minds.
Oh, that's wonderful. What would you say helps people to get comfortable to have these conversations? Obviously, as someone who's a teacher in that space, mm-hmm. you're able to cultivate that a bit. But how do we do this? How do we have these critical race theory types of conversations as lawyers, as colleagues, more regularly in the everyday space, in the workplace?
I think if we allow people to make mistakes, you know, everybody's not going to be perfect on the jargon. Everybody's like, you know, just today, there's a person that's in my class, and they came up to me and said, "These are my pronouns."
Okay.
Right? And so I would have not known their pronouns before.
Okay.
But they also made sure that I understood that it wasn't a critical thing. It wasn't, they weren't upset with me. They didn't want me to feel that what I was doing was incorrect. But they wanted me to know that these are my pronouns.
Mm.
And still was quite satisfied. And I'm glad that they told me today, and I hope that they have an opportunity to listen to this podcast at some point, because they'll know exactly who it is I'm speaking of. And you know, I thought this is right. This is if we can't make a mistake here or anywhere, mm-hmm. then it means it stifles the conversation.
Absolutely agree.
And I think that they understood that, you know. Justice M just isn't quite sure about this, or hasn't asked, or didn't think about asking, and now it's something that's now in my lexicon of thought that I can now say to myself, you know, that's an important thing for me to know going forward. And so I was glad that. So I think we have to be able to do that once we make it comfortable in that environment for them.
Yeah.
Then everybody will feel comfortable to say their narrative.
Right.
Even if the narrative is wrong.
Right, yeah.
You can give a wrong narrative and then now be questioned on it and say, you know what, I think I was wrong on that narrative. Let me think about it again and come back next week.
Yeah, not being like too quick to jump.
That's right.
And I think this is something that I've also been grappling with, being in social justice advocacy for, I guess, over 15 years now.
Yes.
And something that has always bothered me is that we paint people in this homogenous brush if they make one mistake, in that, okay, you said this, therefore you're now in this box of you're this person, you're racist, you're this, you're that. And we just are so easy to just kind of push people into these boxes. And so then people don't even want to engage in discourse.
Yes.
They don't want to speak because they're going to get canceled.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
sometimes there's certain behavior that solicits consequences. And I'm not saying something penal, like you don't gotta go to prison to say the wrong thing. But I think actions should have consequences, or people should be accountable. People should have the humility to take accountability and apologize and
yes,
be able
right.
to do that. However, we need to also foster a space where it's like we believe in growth. Mm-hmm. And I think us as people, at least in my ideologies, I'm a big believer of growth, and I think we just need to afford people that ability to, okay, if you make a mistake, that doesn't mean that you're a bad person, but maybe you said something that's not that great.
Yes, yes, and that's right.
Okay.
That's right. That's okay.
We can learn from that. We
that's
can grow
right.
from that. I just, this is amazing. And, okay, you know what? I just realized that we have been having an amazing conversation and going in all different directions, but our readers, I'm sorry, we're going to have to bring it to a close soon. All of our listeners, I know this is great, but we'll have more of Justice M if you catch him for his critical race theory class, advocacy, his lecture annually. But before we bring it to a close, we do have one last question. This is our most important question.
Okay.
Absolutely. And it's, what was your favorite place to eat when you're here at Queen's Law?
Well, I wish I could say that I had the financial wherewithal to be able to eat out always, or that I could go to Shea Piggy's on a regular basis. So that was not. My favorite place to eat was my house. And so for different reasons, and I'll tell you why. So I would go home on the weekend. I actually went home every weekend.
Wow.
And my mom would cook all this food for me and then freeze it, and then I'd bring it home. So I had all that. But then I had this very unique opportunity to start to learn how to cook things for myself. So I could, like, make Alfredo sauce from scratch.
Wow.
And then I started learning. This is how I started to learn to cook.
Mm.
But I had also the knack for being able